Hello, everyone, and welcome to this another very special episode of the Gestalten podcast. My name is Martin Groschwald, and I'm your host today. And I would like to introduce you to our very special guest, which I'm very, very happy to be here, which is a former Mini Design Director, former Borgward Design Director, and newly owner of his own design studio. Welcome to the show, Anders Warming.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You are most welcome. And we're actually quite excited to have this conversation with you. Loads of things happened for you recently. And first of all, before we start, congratulations on starting your own little design shop.
Thank you very much. No, that's a big step for me. And in many ways, it's a real dream come true as a car designer to be able to do your own thing.
Yeah. Yeah, we will go into quite a bit of detail how this came along and you know what your ambition with this is. But for everybody who's listening to Anders for the first time, who's never heard of him before, there's probably only very few people for which this is the case. As mentioned, Anders has worked for BMW before, Volkswagen as well, mm-hmm. Borgward Design, and is currently based in the Munich area. Danish national has been, how long have you been in Germany now? How many years?
On and off, I would say, but all in all, 15 years, maybe 14, 15 years all now, effectively.
Yeah, so he's an adopted German.
A little bit.
Yeah. A little bit. And I think the most notable cars that you have been involved, or like, you know, if we look back into the last conversation we have had with Takumi Yamamoto, when I asked him the question of what was the one of the most influential projects that unfortunately he couldn't be part of, you were actually part of the Gina. You were part of the BMW Z4, the old one, not the new one, the Mini Vision 100, and alongside the other Mini Rangers that are currently out. And of course, the last big one was the Borgward Isabella.
Mm-hmm.
Did I mention anything that was close to you that you said, you might have said, like, you know, this is worth of this list that's very dear to your heart?
Well, very dear to my heart is actually on that list is the Mille Miglia concept mm-hmm. we did at BMW Mille Miglia, which has a long story behind it, but that's also still sort of like a dream project that I always like to look at, like to reflect on this car. So, but yeah, now you got the main cars, obviously. I think projects that are worth mentioning is just in my role as BMW exterior chief, I basically looked after all BMWs within, let's say, a 4 or 5 year period, which was like 1 series, 2 series, 3 series, 4 series. It was basically pretty much all BMWs that currently on the road. Somehow I was involved with it, wheel program, M Sport packages, that whole lot. Yeah. So that was also a big chunk of my time there. Obviously within huge teams and a lot of people involved, but that was sort of my responsibility.
Very good, very good. But let's, before we come back to the past a little bit, let's talk about the present.
Yeah.
And only a few weeks ago, you have started off your own little design studio, Warming Design.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit more about that. How did that come along? I mean, that's quite a big step for someone who comes, you know, from a vast experience of a corporate culture to take the step of say, like, look, I'm starting something on my own. Obviously, a lot of people have done it before. We can talk about Jujari, we can talk about Chris Bangle as well. Mm. But what was your initial kind of direction you wanted to head to with something like that?
Yeah, it's a very, very valid question. And I have to say, I also, even to this day, I'm a little bit also surprised by myself because it was a big step. But looking back, reflecting a little bit on other decisions I've made in my career, are equal in the sense to what I've done now is basically I like with, and it, I don't think I do it consciously, but it, when I'm looking back, it seems that, you know, every 5, maximum 7 years, I need a big change. I need a big new challenge. You know, obviously sometimes I'm 4 years in a role or 2 years in a role or further. But overall, you know, so at an average, I feel like every fifth year, I need a big, mm-hmm. big change. That was basically as big as it could be because I knew of my career within the automotive industry, and I was aware of, let's say, the presence and the roles that I've had. And I thought to myself, what's the biggest challenge? And that is to return to the roots.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it's a little bit, a lot of you guys probably remember, but I remember it vividly as well, was Not that it's my favorite album of all time, but anyways, in music, I remember in the mid 90s where, you know, or beginning of 90s, there was all a lot of, you know, pop, techno music, whatever. And then, I don't know, beginning of 90s, Nirvana, you know, garage rock. Yeah. Or, like I say, actually the other example is for me, Eric Clapton Unplugged. Yeah. People were so used to hearing a certain thing, and then you had this acoustic record that inspired everyone. Yeah. So for me, this is a little bit me going unplugged. This is how I see it. You know, I've played in big bands and played on big venues. And with what I'm doing now with my car design studio, I'm kind of going unplugged. I am very proud of considering myself a very avid designer, not just by job title, but because my right hand designs stuff. I'm very keen on drawing. I love drawing. I've been very proud of my abilities to draw cars since a little kid. And what comes with higher positions in the corporate world means you spend a lot of time away from drawing. And I was missing it. So I kind of went unplugged with this decision to say, I personally want to increase radically the amount of minutes a day that I'm sketching. That's my goal. I want to be closer to people in a direct rapport on decisions on car design. That you know, car design decisions is my life. It's the air I breathe, right? So it's if it then becomes too many words and too many pointing at things, isn't there a famous car design website called Car Designers Pointing at Things or something like that? You know,
there's a bunch. There's also like, you know, car designers wearing scarves and stuff.
But yeah, exactly. Which I've been guilty of many years, and I know. So, but the point is, I'm I feel that as much as I love really working with high ups and board members and really also being on that scene and being successful on that scene of really respected with, you know, with major stakeholders and decision makers, I also feel that I felt that my right hand needed to be used more. I don't think I was rusty. I was probably one of the car designers that made a big deal out of, I like to get up early in the morning. In Munich, you have to, because if you want to get into office early, it's better to drive early. So usually I would arrive at the FITS, I don't know, 7:15, 7:30. And I have about an hour to sketch every morning. So I've done that for many, many years as one of the leaders, probably who's been sketching the most, basically as a closet sketcher, right? So I get in the morning and I sketch for the full day. So I have sketches, a sketch on top of maybe sketches that I've done myself or other people have done on the server, and give input basically with my right hand. But what I realized is, well, that 1 hour that I really effectively draw every day is too little for myself and my own ambition to become better at my craft. So basically what I'm getting down to is I want to improve my craft. I want to get closer to people, work with customers directly, and have them feel that they're going to get great car design from our interaction, our close interaction, and I can sketch very quickly and high quality what people are looking for.
You've obviously mentioned, like, you know, when you go on your website, there's a bunch of videos that you've released, and one of them is about your philosophy about design. So when it comes to that, and obviously starting something on your own, you just mentioned you want to get back into the craft and, like, you know, do more sketching. How do you think your philosophy will help you with the clients as well? Because, you know, when you come from a corporate background, the philosophy is usually given to you by someone else or by, you know, other stakeholders, or like there's too many decision makers in that process. When you do these projects now with warming design, what is your goal in, like, you know, transcending your own philosophy with these new clients? What is it that you want to achieve with that?
Well, be honest with you, I've always loved that. That sounds a little bit contradictory, but I've always loved working close with very big stakeholders that have very strong opinions. So I'm probably one of the least, not least, but at least I don't think of myself as a very high-nosed designer. I really love to get much input from people. So if it's someone who doesn't know anything about car design, I'm open to that. Tell me what you wish for. Ultimately, people that don't know anything about car design are going to buy our products anyways. So I'm not out on the street teaching people, well, this is a good design, because if they don't like it, they won't buy it. So it's very important for me in a design process and in my design philosophy, and it's always been, to work very, very closely with people and listen to whoever is surrounded. Basically, take every person that has an input, whether it's a supplier, whether it's a board member, whether it's the chief designer you're working for, whether it's people in your own team. Take every opinion super, super seriously. And in many ways, I think it makes you a better designer and a stronger designer the more input you can take on. Mm-hmm. So I actually want to make sure that the input that I get, that I can translate. So what I'm looking for now is, in my role, in my design process, that the people that would work with me directly and want this relationship as sort of a partnership, I want them basically also to see live that anything that they will say and say, what about this? What about that? We can sketch it very quickly. Mm-hmm. We'll put it on paper very quickly, and they can say, oh, that went quick. I was like, yeah, sure. That's what we're here to do. Get quickly to decisions and get consents, making sure, and someone can look at a sketch and say, oh, okay, well, that's actually not what I'm looking for. Mm. Well, let's get that decision in 20 minutes into our conversation, because we're not going to waste more time on that. Mm. Too many things that are going on 3 or 4 weeks where you're checking out and checking out. But since people didn't see the sketch and it was just a PowerPoint outline of a potential, and people are like, oh, if that's what we've been talking about 3 weeks, then I don't want it. Then I'm much more to say, here's a sketch directly, and I want to have quick touch points with people, customers, interaction, making sure that we're not losing time. Yeah. And I think we can condense, especially with a close relationship with me as a person, because I can make things happen basically on my side.
Yeah.
I can deliver models really quick. I can make big changes. I can do all that stuff very, very quickly. And I think working directly with me in a design process will be higher in quality, but also short on time.
Yeah.
And you have more fun. I mean, you know, there's nobody of famous car designers that, will ever refer to a project that they're proud of in 10 years' time or whatever if they didn't have fun doing it.
Yeah.
Whether you're the person paying for it, like you're a big company, you want to design for it, they, even though they may be paying the bill, they still will refer in 10 years, man, we did that and this was an amazing experience. Yeah. And we as designers will say the same thing, but these kinds of processes where you're like, you know, as I always say, circling the airport and people not making decisions and all that kind of stuff, it's grinding. And ultimately, you won't look back at those projects and say, man, we did that.
Yeah.
You're referring to, you know, former projects of mine, and I'm not going to go too much into it right now, but basically BMW Gina was, you know, one of the most intense projects I've ever been involved with, you know, with top designers and everyone super emotional about it. We'll never forget it. And the Milimilia BMW that we did, I have a funny story about that car, basically on a whim.
Yeah.
But like, we weren't supposed to do it, but we did it.
Yeah.
And that kind of cowboy feel about, you know, we're just going to, in, you know, I know you like soccer as well. You know, you're not going to score a goal if you don't take a shot at the goal.
Yeah.
If you're just passing the ball, you know, across in front of the penalty box, well, a goal is never going to happen.
Yeah.
You got to make some shots and you got to go for it, and you're going to shoot more. So, and you can see that in car design as well. We got to produce maximum amount of sketches, keep the speed up. That will produce fun and will produce better design that you'll think of later and say, man, I can't believe I was part of that.
Yeah. Would you say, and this is the interesting point. I mean, you know, when we spoke about a number of things over the past few weeks, and, you know, you told me about your idea of, you know, becoming an independent studio, and with your experience at BMW, would you say that, you know, it might actually, the market needs more of these independent studios to actually take the car design community onto the next level? Because, you know, we hear all this criticism about, you know, almost all big major OEMs, they're not developing as fast enough, it's, you know, stagnating everything. There's no movement, there's no development in there. Would you, I mean, obviously in your kind of case, you would say, yes, of course we need external support. But how do you think about that? How do you think, like, you know, that this external support can really drive things, as, you know, the carrozzeria area?
I think it's a healthy thing. It's all about basically moving the industry forward. I mean, part of what I'm working for in my company is not to say I'm a car designer.
Yeah.
I'm renaming my job and saying I'm a designer of future mobility, future automotive mobility. But it could also be mobility all in all. I don't want, I mean, I'll be happy for all the projects that I'll get my hands on in the next 10, 15 years where it can be a car. That's not an issue. But I'll be equally happy to be part of changing the mobility ecosystem.
Yeah.
I have talks also to cities right now in Europe, where part of my role would not only just be to design the objects themselves, but also to design the experience of how you go into a train station.
Mm-hmm.
And the connectivity you have on your phone when you enter the train station. I mean, I think car design is also part of that. Car design, not in a traditional sense, but the aesthetic experience of a shape, of a form that could be a bench, could be a hook where you attach your bicycle you bring along or whatever. All these things are three-dimensional objects, just like Charles and Ray Eames was making something great out of a living room environment and all the little pieces. That's how I want to spread out. So on the OEM side of things, I think it's about health in sort of the health of the industry. It's like exhaling and inhaling. You got to have the big OEMs that do and bring the quality forward. All the startup companies need the OEMs to show the way. Yeah. On the other hand, as far as inhaling, exhaling, you need checks and balances. It means you need a lot of little speedboats around the big boats that stir up the water and say, hey, we can go here, we can go here, we can go here. So I moved from obviously being involved in some big boats and great endeavors. You know, I'm very, very proud of what we did with Mini with the Next 100 because that was within a big system, but still it had a lot of speedboat character about it. And it was true, honest, authentic. It was a real plausible idea of how would Sir Alec Issigonis, if he was alive today, how would he think about mobility in 2030 onwards?
Yeah.
It's a very serious consideration. What would the founding father of Mini consider for the future? So you can do those things within the big organizations. I was lucky to do that at Mini. I was lucky to do that at Borgward, also with a big support on especially the grandson of Carl Borgward, Christian Borgward, who pushed us and allowed us to go far with it. But also Borgward, of course, is more on the startup side of things as far as its size. So I think it's checks and balances. You need in all sectors, on the big boats, on the small boats, you need each other to push each other, to look. With social media anyways, you know, all big OEMs are using social media to do their checks and balances. And I think a lot of decision makers in big companies are even spending time on Instagram looking at sketches from student projects like them. And you guys are also helping with that, you know, showing that stuff. I follow you guys' stuff, all the stuff I didn't see in Shanghai. I will check up on your, you know, feeds just because of the wealth of visual stimuli we have. And the OEMs are increasingly, and I think with a good speed, opening up to that input. On the other hand, we need the speedboats as well. Good examples like Tesla or whatever. But also now Tesla is also a medium boat and it needs to look at some other speedboats.
Yeah. It's always a renewal process, isn't it? I mean, you know, we see it in the tech industry. We had, internally, we had a really funny conversation recently, which was about, you know, Facebook now, what it means to the young people, pretty much nothing anymore because now they have Instagram. Yeah. So then what is the next thing? We had Snapchat somewhere in the middle that kind of disappeared, but what is the next thing for the next generation? And I think in this kind of renewal process where we are very interesting, and I think this is where your venture is. So it's almost right that it's pretty much at the right time is to say we are going away from just a purely aesthetic proposal of a car to an experience about the car as well. Yeah. And you've mentioned something earlier about, you know, unplugging yourself pretty much. And I think unplugging yourself also probably means a little bit of, it needs to be a beautiful shape, but is it also, you know, worthwhile within this bigger environment? And that's obviously, you know, going to be interesting to see, because I think that's where the really input for the OEMs have to come into, you know, this kind of connection of what is an ecosystem, you know, and how can a car contribute, or like, you know, a vehicle contribute into that ecosystem? And, you know, you can see that with the startups in particular.
I also think that there needs to be a new phase earlier in each project we're going to be doing in the future. Mm. A new phase doesn't mean that we haven't done it before in the industry. I've been at the big companies for many, many years. But I think you need to be more true to make sure that you have that early phase for sure every time. What I'm saying is basically one of the things that I am propagating with my story right now is to say we need to ensure to have an exploring phase before you start creating.
Mm-hmm.
And the exploring phase will allow you to think of context, experience, human feelings, whether you're being faithful to a brand or not a brand. All these considerations need to be looked at before you start putting pen to paper, mm-hmm. even though I like to sketch, I know. But when it really comes down to, I have to visualize and take companies, entire companies, through a process of almost soul searching. Why are you doing what you're doing? That's my big thing. I don't believe we should always start, and a lot of the big companies tend to do that, and I have also been doing that for maybe probably a couple of years, is we get into the what and the how.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we need that car, and it's got that length, and that's what the predecessor has, and this is length. And how are we going to do it? Well, we have a plan over there, and we're going to have these guys put it together. In 95% of the times, it works fine and people are happy. Customers mm-hmm. will get their good cars and they will work and they will squeak and rattle less because quality is going up. So there's always satisfaction with a new car. But what I say is we have to, in the front loading process, in the exploring phase, answer more deeply to the question of why.
Yeah.
Why are we making this car one more time? I'm one of the people that have a lot of times been even stripping down content for facelifts,
mm-hmm.
maybe even from a holistic sustainability thought. Is this really gonna change people's lives?
Yeah.
Or do we rather wanna invest our money in some better material and a better app and better connectivity than doing an entire new front bumper?
Mm-hmm.
I know on the Minis, as you can see right now, I am very open about this, and a lot of my colleagues have agreed with me on that. I was one of the people that made sure we did not do a new bumper.
Mm-hmm.
Put the money in the lamp, in the headlight. We did the Union Jack tail lights.
Yeah, the Union Jack ones, yeah.
We put the money there where you see it and you get an experience. But a lot of times there are bumpers that are being redone. The customer, even though he pays for it, might not even know, oh, that has a new bumper. I didn't even see that.
Mm.
And on a sustainability level, you actually might say, you might put in some input, some costs, some resources into new projects that the customer might not even ask for. So that's why I said before, I really, really want stakeholders, customers, up front, I want to hear their voice. The interesting thing is I know a lot of my colleagues, and I won't name names, obviously, but I've heard a lot of my colleagues that have said, you know, you got to get marketing out of design. You got to let designers do that thing. I don't believe in that.
Mm.
I want to hear the customer who pays for the product. I want to hear his voice. I want to hear his feelings. I want to understand what his dreams are. My dreams, you know, that's actually not the most important thing.
Yeah.
I really, there's nothing better than, and I'm sure any, you know, great chef in a restaurant, if some guy, you know, brings his, you know, plate back out to the kitchen and say, I just want to meet the chef because chef, this food was just excellent and I thank you very much. There's nothing better for a chef in a kitchen to get that response because it comes from the heart. And of course, it's an adrenaline rush for someone. Just like as a band playing at a, you know, at a concert.
Yeah.
If there's no clapping or medium clapping, you feel that.
Yeah.
I've been on stage playing music many times. You feel a medium clapping.
Yeah.
Or you see when people start looking at their watch. You see it 200 meters away.
Yeah.
So why would I play music on a stage? Because I want to touch people.
Yeah.
I want to move them. Why would I want to design a car? Because I want you guys to come up to me 5 years later and say, you know, that design still moves me. That's for me the most, whether I like it or not. I've talked to some people, also some journalists, I've also asked, so how come you don't own your own cars or whatever?
Yeah.
You know, usually when I buy cars, I buy other brands, you know, buy other cars that I admire.
Yeah.
You know, I know that Jean-Claude Bivier, who's the he's the boss of Hublot watches, whatever, and he was doing doing his time, I think Audemars Piguet and Royal Oaks or whatever. His main, the one brand he never worked from was Patek Philippe. And his personal collection is Patek Philippe.
Yeah.
He doesn't collect, there's a, you know, these, there's also, I think it's also a podcast, but there's this, station on in New York called Hodinkee that's got mm-hmm. this watch thing. And Hodinkee, they have these sessions called Talking Watches, mm-hmm. where they have people talking about their, yeah. their watch collections. And then Jean-Claude Biveau comes on and he says, I don't collect my own stuff. I collect the competition. I want to learn from them.
Yeah.
I thought that was a beautiful image. And I thought, wow, okay. Well, that's probably why I don't have a Z4 in my driveway.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to celebrate myself. That's not what I'm here for.
Yeah.
I'm here to listen to what the future will mean for you guys. And my job is to be a little bit catering to your emotions. And that's why that exploring phase I was yeah. mentioning is super important. Invite people in. What are your dreams? What are your wishes? What, you know, how can I help you?
Yeah. Would that be something you would criticize in like the new generation of, let's say, mobility or transportation designers, is that they're not exploring enough, that it's just about high quality sketches, you know, it's just about, you know, it look things looking nice?
I wouldn't criticize it like that. I do feel it myself. I do know we have a tool discussion. What tools are we using, digital or hardware? Yeah. That will obviously, like anything since the Renaissance, tools influence art.
Yeah.
And so I'm amazed with what a lot of the guys in the, for example, in the FITS are doing with their virtual visualization. Mm-hmm. And I realized that we, the sketchers, the designers, we have to up our game to keep up with the guys that visualize in the future, because who's now the real designer?
Yeah.
You know, I might wear a scarf, right? And look like a designer, but no, I'm not wearing a scarf. Yeah. But what I'm saying is that, you know, I don't believe in these old roles.
Yeah.
My biggest ideal for what I want to achieve, and maybe I don't think he was the biggest on marketing, but I would add marketing to my wish for what I can do. But it's always Leonardo da Vinci. If you're thinking about how it was about tools and function and aesthetics and beauty and art, you know, people say beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and I said, yeah, but let's talk about your feelings.
Yeah.
What do you think is beautiful? Let's talk about it. It doesn't hurt to talk about it. You can't just say, well, beauty, let's not talk about it because it's in the eye of the beholder. So, well, then ask the beholder
what
he likes. You know, I do think beauty is very important. I mean, I own a 993, 911, and I can look at that car for hours. And I know that it's the car that, well, next to the Miura that obviously I can't have. But that's a car I could sit at in my garage and that just stare, and I just admire the process and the people that's, you know, made that piece of art. For, I mean, 993 is for me just like so wonderful because it adheres to everybody's sense of beauty. I mean, the, you know, coefficient of people that don't like a 993 is rarely small, right? So, but it doesn't mean that it's any less intellectual. There's stuff form-wise and proportions and package-wise and story-wise happening on a 993 that, you know, goes really deep.
Yeah.
That it's not just a pretty face. It's got depth and depth and depth.
Yeah.
So I do believe in beauty.
Yeah.
I do believe in automotive beauty. So I cannot criticize anyone, you know, who's sketching tons of sketches. Quite the contrary, I believe 100 sketches is better than 50 because it makes you a better drawer and you practice your craft. So practicing the craft is, we all know, you know, you need 200 sketches, 300 sketches. If you want to get close to something that's anywhere good, that's maybe one thing we could say. Because we are such a fast-moving world and we want to impress, you know, I would say don't post your first sketch online. Post your 201st sketch.
Yeah.
Then it'll be good.
Yeah.
Then we'll talk about it. That's probably what we're trigger-happy on posting our sketches.
Yeah.
You know, we gotta spend more time practicing our craft, less time maybe consuming what other people do, and really practicing our own craft.
You were obviously in a position at multiple companies where you had to decide quite a lot. So when it comes to criticizing or, you know, giving, you know, new thoughts to your team that you're working with, or, you know, it can also be intern students, whatever. How would you go along with that then? Because, you know, obviously, well, criticizing is part of a, an important part of getting better.
But criticizing, I mean, okay, I don't want to paint or to put myself in a position that some might say that I know better than others. It's not, I don't, not what I want to say. But one thing, if I may say so, that I've always been very, very good at is to be unselfish about a design process, not put myself and my opinion in the foreground. That mobilizes people's feeling of being allowed to do. It's the strangest thing. It has nothing to do with what I'm saying right now, but I did watch, you know, like 10 years ago, because I love the Beatles and all that kind of stuff. There's a DVD from Paul McCartney called Wingspan, where he left Beatles, and the DVD explains the 10 years of him out of the Beatles and how do you deal with the post-Beatles phase? Obviously, very relevant topic for me. How do I deal with not being at the Beatles anymore and have my own band called The Wings now? Yeah. So it's the same thing, not that I'm Paul McCartney, but that thinking. And but that's another thing. What Linda McCartney often said to Paul McCartney was that sentence, "It's allowed."
Yeah.
And that stuck with me for many, many years, like in a design process. It's allowed.
Yeah.
It's just paper. Opinions are allowed.
Yeah.
So in a design process, what we've done, and the best example I can give you is, and I'm really, really proud of that car. It's next, I would say the Borgward Isabella, also similar process, but especially the Mini Next 100 is the car that really, every time I see it, I still am so proud of it. You know, everyone involved, you know, the entire interior team, the entire exterior team, color materials. You know, I wouldn't even start naming names now, because then I wouldn't even know where to stop.
Yeah.
It was an incredible, incredible project. The way I started the project was I did what I call future breakfast. So I brought croissants and orange juice, and we said we meet on our surface. We have a space where we do our studio reviews in the mini design studio upstairs. And then I would say, everyone, just make your coffee, bring your tea, whatever. And we're going to spend 4 hours every Thursday morning and talk about future. And you should bring sketches, what you think are cool and what you like and what you would do. And this is a free-for-all. It's allowed.
And not just from cars, like anything.
Anything. Future breakfast. Yeah. We talk future. We're going to just dive in, whether we want to talk Isigonis, whether we want to talk driving shoeboxes, whether we want to talk about beauty of a 911. We'll talk beauty of an old Mini. Yeah. We'll talk about anything. It's allowed. And I just kind of moderated a little bit. I had opinions, and people know I have strong opinions about things I like or not like. But I also just told anyone, if I'm allowed to have strong opinions, you're allowed to have strong opinions. Yeah. Speak up, honey.
Yeah.
I want to hear what you think. And we had walls of sketches. People stopped bringing really raunchy design stuff, because now it's allowed.
Yeah.
You're not going to get someone saying, yeah, I don't like that sketch. Yeah. Some chief designer turning his nose up. All I'm saying is, tell me your story. I want to know what's behind the sketch. And people will be like, well, what I thought about was this and this and this. And if I may say something, like, you should say something. If you're not, that's why I say in the one video that I have a very specific word that I chose in the process video I have on my website. As I say, it's our duty to look at things. And I use the word duty.
Yeah.
Also because our hours are being paid for.
Yeah.
You know, if we're in a design team and we have young designers coming out of design school and they're super talented or whatever, why are you holding back?
Yeah.
Why are you not voicing your opinion? What are you afraid of?
Yeah.
Quite on the contrary, I have to step on your toes and say, it's your duty to voice your opinion about the future. Otherwise, why would we pay your salary? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Let's be open and let's speak in the world of it's allowed. So the result of that was the Mini Next 100 that just, I think, you know, blew it out of the park. You know, it was such a deep car. We allowed to do a Mini that didn't have, you know, the classic, you know, round headlights up on the bonnet. You know, Christopher Weil, I will mention his name, and also Stefan Goeppel, whatever. They were so powerful in the way they put, they said, let's not have the eyes up. let's just put the round inside the grill that we're seeing through anyways. And it was like, okay, and you have no dashboard. And you can have a Mini and the character of urban Mini mobility without the round headlights. And it still emotionally got us because it was such a beautiful car. So for me, that's the best example of how to motivate people to do this. It's allowed. And not only that, it's our duty as designers and as visualizers to put onto paper what the future can look like.
Is that what holds a lot of, let's say, you know, creative companies, and I don't just want to include car companies in that, but general kind of product companies back, is like that they're not looking, or like, you know, that they don't think it's allowed. It's more just like, let's follow the path that we're given.
Yeah, for sure. And also I would say that it's a generational thing. And you know, well, I'll do whatever I can not to get old. I mean, there's some wonderful TED Talks online. I mean, I'm not the only one speaking about these things. And I want to live it. And I want to be a little bit of a spearhead for this stuff. I plan also to be involved with many, you know, talks, you know, where I, you know, basically speak to an audience that are creative. And my 50% of my job right now, next to obviously creating with my right hand and sketching and making, is also to motivate the design community. Say, you are empowered. I remember when Chris Bangle told us back in the 90s, and I was starting the Z4. You know, I think good design comes from unselfishness. And what Chris, he said in a meeting, I remember, because I you know, I think it's I can say this here openly. I love Chris. He's just he's my mentor. He's my everything. He's done so much good for BMW design and for us and Davide and you know, everyone. I mean, it's been really a pleasure to work with Chris, and I still see him a lot. But the thing about Chris, I remember he said to us, you know, he says, "You guys are the agents of change."
Yeah,
I still get goosebumps when I hear that. First, it sounds like agents. I'm like, that sounds cool, you know, Men in Black, you know, like, you know, kind of like that. And you're like, we're the agents of change. You know, agent also as far as, you know, the physics of agents of putting things. You know, we make that difference. And you have all this production methods, and then the designer comes in and go like, got to be like that, that, and it makes a big difference. Whether you sell 500,000 or two cars, you know, the agents of change are big. So that was Chris' word. I'm not going to take it from him, but that was his way of empowering us and say it's allowed.
Yeah.
But also, Chris is also a tough guy with that, because he's also saying, you guys are responsible. I want to see more from you guys.
Yeah.
Don't hold back. Give me, give me, give me, give me. We have tough meetings with Chris for many, many, many years. And I love him to bits, but I mean, he's torn me apart in meetings like you wouldn't believe. I felt like I was, you know, dying, bleeding, wondering why. And he's like, I just want to see if you really wanted it.
Yeah.
I'm going like, that was it? you put me through all that and now. And he goes like, yeah, but I know where you stand now, and I follow you. Yeah. I mean, Gina was an example, you know, or I was trying to, when I was doing advanced design from 2005 to 2007, we were doing a lot of the new interior volumes where we came up with the layering stuff or whatever. And I, you know, minute he heard things that sounded like things he'd heard before, he would stop me. He's like, I don't want you to use that word again. I'm like, why not? It's like, no, I want to hear new.
Yeah.
So accidentally in the next sentence, I used that word again, X, Y, C, whatever that was. And he's like, stop, I don't want to hear that word. That says past, I want to hear future from you. He was tough on making sure that we don't hold back and really test on what we really stand for.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, you know, obviously he as a person is an agent of change, a big inspiration. That's how the Z4, as an anecdote, happened. I was speaking with a friend the other day, and I was telling him this story, and he was like, oh, you got to tell this story at some point. But it still is a very emotional story for me on the Z4, because I was in a design studio, you know, at DesignWorks, in the Studio 9, it was called, at DesignWorks in California, where I started. And Chris and Chuck Pelley had asked me to join back in the 1997. And 1998, I was sitting, in 7, 8, I was sitting in a massive studio. I was surrounded by, you know, big cats, right? And I was called the kid, right? Yeah. I was the kid. And it was Marek Reichman. It was Marek Georgievic. It was Chris Chapman, Eric Goplin. Henrik Fisker was our boss. I mean, we were surrounded by heavy hitters, right? So I was like just happy to be there, right? And they were saying, you should just do this project, whatever. And the successor Z3, Chapman will do one and Georgievic will do one. And I was like, okay, yeah, fine, cool. So fine. And then I had been practicing sketches to hold my pen in a different way that I'd learned from Art Center. I was sketching a little bit different. And one of the most beautiful things, I think, even considering what happened, because I was sketching differently, that was the beginning of flame surfacing. Mm-hmm. Because what had happened at Art Center, I had an experience with a teacher because I was doing life drawing, naked people mm-hmm. drawing, sitting there drawing that, and I was holding the pen like I draw cars.
Yeah.
And then my teacher came over and he's like, oh, you car designers, you always hold the pen the wrong way.
Yeah.
You're doing the outline and not the shapes. I said, what do you mean? He's like, you're just doing the shape, the outline of what you see, and then you fill in the muscle and the bone structure and all this stuff. I want you to do the bone structure, the muscle, and then derive the outlines.
Yeah.
And my head went, I love that, right? Just like, so I had that in the back of my mind, do the bone structure, the muscle, and then derive at the outline. So what I was playing around with, independently of not knowing I was going to get a model, was I was sketching on a very soft paper with a Barol Prismacolor, you know, twisted shapes. So I was doing the muscle and then deriving at the outlines of the car. And then what I was saying, the very unselfish story was Marek Georgievic. He literally came by. He was also very involved with the original Rolls-Royce Phantom at the time. So he had his head a little bit in the Rolls-Royce ambitions, I think. And he was told he was going to do a Z3. It was going to call it the Z3 successor. And then he came around my sketches and he's go like, oh, look at the kid. He's got it going on. He should do a model. So he gave me his model.
Yeah.
And I was like, what are you doing? He's like, no, I love those sketches. You know, Henrik, you know, ask Anders to do a model instead. I don't need to do it. I'll, you know, I don't have it. He had some sketches. I thought it was nice. And then I got to do the model. And I did the sketches, or the scale model with Brady Gall, who's an excellent clay modeler at DesignWorks. And we did the shapes.
Yeah.
And that was the birth of flame surfacing because it was the twisting surfacing on planes. So it's kind of a beautiful story because I wasn't really supposed to be doing it.
Yeah.
And the unselfishness of Marek Georgievic just meant, you know, go ahead, you got the better game.
Yeah.
You know, that was really cool.
I mean, this is, you know, what we discussed, I think, quite a few times in the podcast already is this kind of understanding as well when someone is better. And, you know, it's like, look, this guy deserves to go for that shot and don't be that selfish.
Exactly.
Just because someone tells you you should do it. It's like, no, this is much better. And I mean, this is one of the biggest qualities I think you can find, not just in a designer, but in a human being, is to understand, hey, this guy is better, you know. And
I think that was back to the question you had before about how to go about managing a team to think freely, is that when things, not only when, because they will come up, or it's not if they come, it's when they come up. The ideas of individuals come up. They will come up at spurts or convictions. And you can tell from people's eyes if they stand behind what they say or not.
Yeah.
If they're telling something in a design presentation that means they want you to nod, they will say whatever. But if they kind of look up a little bit and look a little bit away and a little bit dreamy in the eyes and they start philosophizing about what they thought would be really good, you got to listen carefully.
Yeah.
Because then they're kind of going to a deeper spot in their you know, verbalizing of an idea or a sketch. If you got, I think that's a talent you have to nurture as a design chief, to listen to that. And that's back to the first point I made about I want to listen to the customer.
Mm.
I want to look in his eyes and see how he feels. I want to kind of get a feel for, is his body language like, yeah, okay, there's another car? Or is his body language upright going like, whoa, okay, cool.
Yeah.
You know, and you could tell from people around you. And obviously I've been fortunate to work around someone like Chris Bangle for so many years where you can tell immediately whether he feels it or doesn't feel it as a customer, as a boss. Because just like I'm his customer, he's my customer.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just like you say, being unselfish, looking at looking across the line and looking at the other people. And if they're not feeling well, people working on a project, doesn't matter if you got, if you're right, it's not going to be a pretty project,
yeah.
and you're not going to be happy about it in 10 years' time. Another great example of that I'm really proud of having worked with was with Louis de Fabri-Becker on the Mini Superleggera. Basically, that car we shared.
Yeah.
The Mini design team with my leadership and the super the touring design leadership from Louis.
Yeah.
And he just posted a picture of it today on Instagram. Yeah. And he, you know, obviously, you know, tagged me on it. Yeah. And when I post something, I tag him on yeah. it. It's not about him or me. We know we did this car together yeah. and we were in the car together when we drove it into Villa
yeah,
d'Este.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, we love each other for that, knowing that I know what you brought and he knows what I brought.
Yeah.
And it's, that's, you know, you got to have that unselfishness, I think, yeah. in order to succeed in this industry. The minute you start pushing yourself forward, yeah. maybe some people sometimes have accused me of being, mm-hmm. you know, a little pushy
mm-hmm.
on things. I do think you have to push things to stir things up a little bit. So sometimes maybe with me, it can get misinterpreted as being selfish or, you know, arrogant or whatever. But I'm saying, no, you got to look behind the surface.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm pushing for everyone. I'm pushing for all of that. And you got to stir up a little bit of dust sometimes to wake people up in the tracks. So yeah, you know, there are certain leaderships, maybe I belong to that,
yeah.
that will also put my foot down and say, okay, I've heard everything now. We're going to go through that door.
Yeah.
Okay, sometimes you got to do that. But I think ultimately 90%, 80% of the time you can follow the swarm intelligence.
Yeah. You've been around a little bit, obviously, in different countries. You're from Denmark, you now live in Germany, been to the US a little bit. How did, you know, living in all these different countries, you know, shape your professional life as well?
I think... culture is basically the reason why we're here also in car design, because I think that we're contributing to culture in cars and what we do. Because, you know, obviously as a Danish kid, I know how many kilometers I've walked to the train station to get the latest car magazine, you know, and it's like once in a blue moon, there was even a new magazine that would make it out to where the train station was in that part of Denmark where I was living. I mean, you were under a rock back in the days, you know. It was amazing. I even knew what Pininfarina was or whatever. So back in the day, I always had a humble feeling towards car design. Like it was always greater than obviously me as a little Danish guy. Mm-hmm. So I think that has shaped my professional way of working, meaning I always find myself as dynamic as I may be and pushy for certain things. One of the things that I always pride myself on is being humble and not being boasting. You know, I like to talk about these projects, and I hope you can all understand that I speak about them in I would say
appreciation
for the people that I did it with and the moments that I experienced with Chris or with Louis or with Christopher Weil or and all these people that I love dearly. So it's not a selfish thing, and I think the thing I've learned most about the, you know, cross-cultural thing is humbleness.
Yeah.
That you are just another fly on the wall. You might have a title, chief designer Mini or chief exterior designer BMW, or you know, these are wonderful titles, but you're still in the big cosmic thing. You know, I think humbleness is okay. That being said, another thing that contradicts that I've learned. Next to the humbleness is honesty.
Yeah.
And learned that in many cultures, honesty will be rewarded. And, you know, honesty also means telling the truth, you know, but also in the moment to say what you think.
Mm-hmm.
So that that is more being true to myself, saying whichever culture. And I've dealt with a lot of American, and I know how that works. I know I've dealt with a lot, obviously, with Germans. I've dealt with Italians because I studied in Italy. Lately, I spent 2 years with Borgfat, where I was much in China and dealt a lot with Chinese colleagues. So as much as I have respect for the other cultures around me, I also try to look at myself and make sure that I'm faithful to myself.
Mm-hmm.
So being honest about what I think, even though I know, well, in this culture, you don't do this or you don't do that. You know, as long as if you're being cordial and if you are keeping your demeanor, you know, in a good, you can still be direct and say, yes, I know, but this is how it is. And this is my position. Yeah. So on the one hand side, the humbleness of where you are, which I think is the world openness. The other side is also you got to keep your own line. You got to be true to yourself. Just because you're in a culture where that and that is expected, in an American culture or in a Chinese culture or in a German culture, that and that is expected. I still think you have to look at yourself in the mirror and say, okay, well, who am I?
Yeah. And I don't... Is it just a copy?
Exactly. You don't want to go to meetings and just, you know, blend in with the wall. Because again, also like I said before, you have a duty to speak up.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it would be nice if you'd speak up. You have a duty, you know, the clock's ticking. The processes are going. If you don't say it now, and please say it in a cordial fashion, yeah. And I will also adhere to that. But you got to say it. Yeah. You got to, you know, say, okay, well, we have 5 more minutes and I know we're trying to be nice to each other, but I'm leaving in 5 minutes and I got to tell you this. Yeah. I think that might also be where I have a little bit of a rep of being very direct.
Mm.
But people that have worked with me for many, many years also know that, just like Chris, you know, that is only because of time is money.
Yeah.
And as long as we're friendly to each other, certain things we've got to condense.
Yeah.
You know, we can circle the airport, but let's move on.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. All right. Then let's wrap it slowly up. And as you are a very special guest to us, you will also get 3 questions. As everybody does when they join us on these special podcasts. So, first question: who was the most influential designer that you've worked with?
Chris Bangle.
It's the second one who says Chris Bangle. Takumi was also in there. Yeah.
No, Chris Bangle all the way. I mean, by a large margin. I mean, I would give my right hand to work with Jujaro.
Mm.
No, I wouldn't give my right hand. Give my left hand, maybe. No, but I would. It would be a dream to collaborate with Jujaro just because of his catalog and his road through, of course, the early of Bertone, the Ghia years, and obviously the Ital design, even down to Brea concept and so forth. We just kind of say that's amazing. So, you know, that would have been a dream for me to work with this, you know, Jujaro. But the person I've worked with that have given me that has been Chris all the way. But just because of his human approach, his complex, you know, human complex way of understanding all the things that matter in car design, just by a long margin.
Cool. Number 2, which project that you did not work on would you love to have been part of? You can go far as, you can go back as far as you would like.
Yeah. Well, I would say, I mean, obviously, on my top 3 list, there's definitely a lot of them that, you know, where I would say, you know, Bugatti 35 or Lamborghini Miura and stuff like that. I mean, 35 is amazing. Miura as well. But I would say, I would go for a surprising one, the Franco Scaglione Bat cars. You know, I would say those 3 cars, Bat 5, 7, and 9.
Yeah.
Especially 5 and 7. You know, the early Bertone, Franco Scaglione, you know, my word. I mean, you know, the whole area, I mean, also what happened then with the Disco Volante that they did over touring, whatever. But I mean, you know, the bat cars are, oh my God, that is like, ah, oh, it's such rock and roll. It's so wonderful.
Cool. And number 3, if I would give you any money in the world, what car would you buy?
Yeah, it has to be Lamborghini Miura. Has to be Lamborghini Miura.
We're having a little bit like, you know, like when we talk to these people, like to you guys, and the Lambos always come up in
the Miura.
We had
well, Countach also.
We had Takumi last time at a Lambo as well. I don't remember which one it was. Yeah, it was a Miura as well, I think. So yeah, the Miura.
The reason why the Miura is such a strong thing is that it's the most sensitive, excellent, you know, execution of I would say masculinity femininity, you know, beauty and power, and that balance, just like I think the 911 also has beauty and power, when it's about, you know, sports cars as well. I mean, even a, you know, an E32 BMW 7 Series is amazing from that standpoint of beauty and power, you know, a, you know, litheness. I love the word lithe, L-I-T-H-E, you know, but I mean, the Miura is just such a complex, you know, sculpture.
Yeah.
And it has what I loved about our old Mini, you know, the original Mini is the, you know, the transverse engine V12.
Yeah.
The fact that you get a transverse V12 into that car and you get those proportions with a little bit of dash to axle, and it's such a sexy car. It's, and I don't think there's a man or a woman on earth that stand in front of that car that don't get some sort of adrenaline kick just by looking at it. So Miura, yeah. I mean, I do like the Mercedes 300 SL.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know it's very gauche. I know it's very gothic.
Gullwing,
you know,
or?
Gullwing.
Yeah.
I do also like the open one because it's got a better rear axle, but a different thing. but the 300 SL, I think it's amazing. The interesting thing is I also know that there are people that say, I don't know. And that's then holds me back and say, okay, well, maybe I see a lot in it and loved it. You know, but the thing about the Miura is just, I there's very little people on this planet that will turn away and say, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because it's so, if you talk about customer feedback and what people like, that's the one. That's cool. The one to get.
Yeah.
That's the one to get.
All right. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. People can find you on your website if they want to contact you.
warming-design.com.
And also on Instagram, of course, as we are all now in the social media aspect.
Anders Warming Design.
Anders Warming Design. And so Anders, thanks a lot for being with us. And to all of our listeners, of course, make sure that you listen to the old ones as well. Listen, you know, we have another one coming up very, very soon. And thanks for listening. And we will hear you very, very soon. And you will hear us very soon.